I wanted to put some tropes into the discussion about the relation between Kant's essay on perpetual peace and some preoccupations around the transformation processes of our cities, our own spaces of operation. I'm particularly interested in what Tom just tried to investigate in his sounding of differences. And so the preoccupation that I'm trying to put out is one about a disillusionment, and or better, a condition where we find constantly negating the very possibility of being neutral, of not having a position, of not taking part, of not engaging. So I think that it's quite obvious. The moment that we say there's a possibility of being neutral, the immediate condition that we encounter is that of impossibility. You cannot be neutral. You cannot not have a position. It doesn't make sense. You will always take part. You will always mask. You will always operate, as it were, as in a situation of deceit, because you will actually be fooling yourself in dismantling a position of political and social engagement. The particular interest that I have in the notion of neutrality in relation to Kant's essay is exactly in the formulation of Kant of the possibility of having a public debate. And in Kant, as we know, in the essay on the perpetual peace, the possibility of having a public debate necessarily is linked to the condition of withdrawing from the public, of a secret clause. As you know, there's a secret clause in the outlining of the argumentation towards perpetual peace, and that is that every, let's say, international condition that engages nations and states and organizations of communities and peoples should not have any moment of withdrawal from the public. Everything should be completely transparent. The public debate is about transparency and a possibility of engaging, say, without any deceit. With one exception, intellectuals should advise the governor, the sovereign, in a situation withdrawn from the public, in secret. The only secret clause that is acceptable is that of the intellectual debating about peace, about the conditions of peace, with the sovereign, either the king, the prince, the government, the republic. And this particular condition of withdrawal is where I find the condition of neutrality being particularly interesting. So what does it mean to withdraw? What does it mean not to engage in a condition that is actually trying to establish conditions of peace? So to take some of the previous idea of the sonic interpretation, and the, I would like to use a particular idea, and that is the fathoming, the sonar impulse that sends down into the abyss and perceives a delay. I'm particularly interested in this notion of the delay in trying to understand differences in relation to withdrawal, because it might be that the way that we consider the condition of withdrawal is exactly about, not about space, it's not that we withdraw from public space, but we withdraw in the sense of we delay our engagement. So possibly we have to think of neutrality not as a condition of space, of establishing, let's say, a space that is outside the political arena, but it's a withdrawal in time. It's a withdrawal and a delay in time. In that sense, I think that what I'm about to tell you might find some resonances with the sonic. So what is it that we are doing when we establish a discourse in public, if not trying to reformulate conditions of citizenship. What is this particular forum that we are creating is, of course, an issue of establishing a situation of citizenship. The conditions that allow us to be taking part of a discussion, interrupting a discussion, shouting on top of someone else, speaking on a low tone. So the particular forum that we establish is on many levels what we might call a polity. It's what the Greek called the politeia. It's the organization, the political organization, the political structure of our living together. And as we know, it used to be completely unmediated. The sound had to reach your ear in a direct earshot. No mediation could have been possible in the creation of that public forum. No technical mediation, no reorganization, for instance, of the public appearance through text. No technological mediation through the dispersal of your discourse, let's say, in digital form or with the loudspeakers. So the idea of the forum, of being together, and the idea of organizing that particular polity is immediately perceived as a space. So what is the relation between the forms of that system of polities and the forms of our spaces of operation that operate at the moment of withdrawal, the moment of neutrality, of not engaging? What we usually encounter when we start discussing the notion of neutrality in terms of space is almost a plethora of returns to, yet again, Berlin. The division, the wall, the barbed wire, the no man's land, the partition, the ex-territorial condition, the camp. So the idea that we almost physically could cut out a space and from the idea of the political. My interest in understanding the condition of neutrality, on the contrary, try not to engage with, let's say, the particular conditions, let's say, the barriers, the borders, the idea that you just step out into another room which is neutral and you're not any longer political, but to try to understand the relation between polity and the spaces of our contemporary life as an architecture. So architecture is not the space, but it's the relation between the space and the political life. And it's a relation that is shifting. It's shifting because we engage in redoing and undoing and reformulating our political environments, our way of being together. And as the quote of Kant in the upper part of this room says, any transformation in one part of the world affects transformation of the other part, because the Earth, as we know, is round, and particular movement on one element, because of this finitude, will influence elements on the other side. So we are in a situation where our engagement with the doing and the construction of our polities is constantly negotiated. And our spaces of operation are constantly negotiated as well. And if we start looking at neutrality as a mode of sounding that particular shifting relation, we might start to discover modes of operation of contemporary life that go beyond that of the mere, let's say, intervention for an effect. In other words, what happens when every step that we take into the establishment of our cities as a political forum not necessarily has an immediate effect in the establishment, let's say, of a situation of inclusion? What if there is a delay? What if there is an echo? And what kind of echo is there in that situation? In this sense, I would like to explore some particular conditions that throughout, let's say, the last 50 years we have encountered in the establishment of spaces of neutrality, not as spaces that try to establish a condition of neutrality, because that is obviously unachievable. Everybody becomes really angry because you never are neutral. So what if, rather than insinuating the impossibility of neutrality, we start discussing the conditions by which neutrality is practiced? So neutrality no longer conceived as a status, but as a practice. As a practice that realigns a polity and a space of operation. As a practice that is constantly negotiating its conditions. So the first element that I would like to put into this discussion about neutrality as a practice is, of course, the complete dismantlement of the legal conditions of neutrality with the establishment of the UN Charter. As we know, the UN Charter does one thing: it outlaws war. If we cannot be in a state of war, we cannot be neutral. Because to be neutral is a condition that pertains condition of war. Not to take part in an armed conflict is what describes neutrality. And what describes neutrality not only in its particular conditions, but demands certain sets of articulations and modes of operation. You're not allowed to discriminate between your commercial partners. You're not allowed to allow, let's say, to open your territory to the passage of one army and not to the other. You're not allowed to host temporarily an army, and so on and so forth. With the establishment of the United Nations Charter, the condition of war is no longer existent. What happens is that the space of sovereignty is enlarged, extended, carved, reorganized, both from above, from beneath, and multiplied. So suddenly, states are accountable. We can take part in a judgment of the absolute power over a territory. That means that the particular polity that organizes a state is no longer absolute, is no longer a sovereignty. Now, the engagement of the United Nations in the discourse of peace is an undoing of the possibility of sovereignty. So what happens in that moment when sovereignty is reorganized and realigned? The first condition is, of course, neutrality is no longer valid. But at the same time, we see, with the introduction of the United Nations Charter, almost a multiplication, an exponential development of practices of neutrality, starting with the operations of the UN itself, the UN peacekeeping missions, that since 1945 have multiplied the conditions of military engagement of the United Nations organizations to a situation where, if we count how many days of war there have been since 1945 to now, and count how many deaths there have been since the end of World War II, we are in a situation that outnumbers by 150 times World War II. The last years of international peace are actually not just a dismantlement of the possibility of conceiving war, of legalizing war, but exactly the conditions of establishment of practices of neutrality shows that neutrality is engaging in that fuzzy condition, in that gray zone of constant mixture between war and peace. In a situation where conflicts are no longer just, say, the interruption of peace, or peace the interruption of war. But on the contrary, conflicts become ambient, become constant conditions of modulation and intensification of particular forms of what some might call intensified discussions, intensified information exchange, intensified knowledge production. So we can start understanding conditions of neutrality as a particular way of operating in a knowledge production system. That is to say, violence is a form of knowledge production. It's not no longer just to be conceived as an extension of politics with other means, but it's particularly interesting to consider politics as an extension of war without in other means. So there's a particular situation where we have a shift, where the investigation of a practice of neutrality like the UN peacekeeping mission is no longer about understanding a condition of territories where we have one conflict engaging with the other, but a modulation. So the border is no longer clearly fixed. It's no longer clearly a demarcation. It's a situation of inclusion, let's say, to the extent where we can no longer be outside. So what is it to be neutral if we cannot be outside of a conflict that is becoming ambient? I think that one of the ways that by which we might start looking at this particular establishment of a space of neutrality is to consider neutrality as an ultimate form of power, as a form of power that tries to undo and outplay a conflictual condition, a situation where neutrality engages in a particular specific diagram of power, undoes it, and establishes a different set of relations. An example. In the years that have spanned since 1964, the longest UN peacekeeping mission, the one on the island of Cyprus, has established a condition where, let's say, it was similar to the wall in Berlin. The so-called green line that spans across the east-west divide of the island of Cyprus is probably the most clear example that neutrality is not a status but a practice. In itself, the green line that separates the northern self-proclaimed Republic of Turkish Northern Cyprus from the island in a whole, which is the Republic of Cyprus, that particular line, which is defined as the ceasefire line, is nothing more than some sandbags, some anti-car bomb barriers, some checkpoints, some organization of surveillance, floodlights, and so on. In itself, it's nothing special. In itself, that condition is just a presence of, let's say, a ceasefire line, surveyed constantly by the UN. And the UN peacekeeping mission there does nothing else than witness the fact that that line doesn't change. So every day, the troops of the Blue Beret will go up and down this 270 kilometers of the green line and photograph, observe, not take part in the conflict, but just be in a situation of spectators, not acting, but withdrawing from action. So they are just witnessing in the sense not of taking, let's say, being the situation where you observe in order to give account publicly of a condition, but you're just witnessing and recording as you would be witnessing, you know, the passage of time in a monument. What is really interesting about the condition of operation of that particular, let's say, transformation of the political condition of Cyprus through the practice of neutrality of the UN peacekeeping mission is all the other practices that start populating Cyprus around it, within it, and across it. So Cyprus suddenly becomes the hub for the entire network of operation of the UN in the Middle East. It becomes the area where, after the attacks in Baghdad in 2003 at the UN headquarters, the entire UN staff is deployed to. It is the area where the civilian staff in Beirut is withdrawn from during the 2006 battle with the Israeli forces. It is the area where the US military, in conjunction with the British military, operate their surveillance technology. the so-called echelon system, with the organization of the infrastructure for control of telecommunication. It is the area that allows the organization, or better, the transformation of the island of Cyprus into a touristic resort, where mostly Northern European buyers would build their own villas with attached swimming pools on land that is no longer directly accessible to its direct owners that are displaced in the south. It is the area that allows particular conditions of smuggling of both people and arms. For instance, at the border between the ghost town of Famagusta and at the conjunction with the city of Varosha, where you would find Russian, let's say, oligarchs dealing with Middle Eastern oligarchs as well in arms, next to an abandoned city that used to be the seat of one of the most prosperous Cypriot populations. Or it is the area that you will find engages with particular forms of prostitution, or particular reorganization of religious life, with the Maronites combining their efforts with the Jewish population and expelled from the Greek and Turkish diaspora around the Bosphorus. So what is interesting about the conditions that particular line does is how the system of neutrality, that is, not to take part, establishes and undoes completely the very possibility of understanding differences. It makes the partition indifferent. It makes the partition yet just one of the many differences. And that is exactly what neutrality does. It establishes a set of organizations, a different relation between a polity and a space. A second example, in a completely different part of the world, operating where in a radically different way than, let's say, partition. Let's look at the Kashmir, the valleys that are contested and contended between Pakistan, India, China, and Afghanistan. That particular area where the UN tries to maintain open passes, open flows, open possibilities of crossing the mountains in a particularly strategic location in the world. There, the conditions of neutrality and the practices of neutrality have nothing to do with containment, have nothing to do with blockage, with the erection of barriers, but on the opposite, are really engaging with the possibility of flow, of circulation, of devoiding, let's say, complete control over a territory, but allowing a number of relationship at a distance. The interesting thing of the condition in the Kashmir is exactly what happens when, for instance, during the 2007 relief efforts after the Pakistani earthquake, the different troops on the ground start sharing information that is almost parachuted, as it were, from the satellite system that controls that that passage, so that the Pakistani troops start sharing information with the Red Cross, with Médecins Sans Frontières, with the Indian troops, with even the Chinese troops. Suddenly, that particular condition of neutrality establishes a space, a particular political space that is immediately then ensconced and wrought in the physical layout of the Kashmir. It establishes, for instance, the transformation of the the Himalayan passes in order to maintain their roads constantly wide. It allows them to reorganize the system of draining the rivers. Basically, it allows inhabitation of the mountainous landscape. I think this is a particularly interesting situation, exactly because it shows us that architecture can be used to explore a particular mode of relation between, let's say, human activities and their production of space. So where architecture is not just, let's say, the concretization of a particular political force, but it's a way of understanding two things that are changing at the same time, the political construction and the physical construction. A third example of a space of neutrality that becomes, say, symptomatic of the ways by which we try constantly to engage in our practices of establishing, let's say, a withdrawal from public and direct engagement in politics. One of the heroes of neutral activities is Martti Ahtisaari, the Nobel Prize. President Martti Ahtisaari, former president of the Republic of Finland, has been engaged for many, many years in the establishment of the Kosovo as an independent country. And as we know, there is a particular resolution of the UN that says that the territorial integrity of Serbia will be preserved. And at the same time, the UN is engaged in allowing, let's say, a particular chunk of Europe to become independent. That means that there's a particular fuzzy condition of the operation of neutrality. That means disengagement from a direct political intervention in negating Serbia access to that particular territory, but at the same time allowing the particular territory to establish itself as a country. And Martti Ahtisaari, in his acceptance speech of the Nobel Prize, says one interesting thing, that the condition of neutrality is just an acceptance of a condition of peace. So that is, peacekeeping is not making peace. So there's a distinction between, let's say, a condition where we have to negotiate the, let's say, the bits and pieces of peace with, say, the processes that allow us to establish peace in the first place. And how do we distinguish that moment from, let's say, the negotiation or the intensified knowledge production, knowledge exchange that was the war? If war is a situation of extreme discourse, extreme transmission and receival of information from and against your enemy, what is that modulation towards, let's say, an establishment of peace? When is the moment when we say peace is done and now we have to keep it? When is the moment when we actually can begin, let's say, a process of perpetual conditions of peace? And what is interesting is exactly that in order to do that transition, Martti Ahtisaari points out, you have to establish a completely different set of power relations. And you have to, for instance, undo the condition of complete sovereignty, that is, complete power within a territory. And you have to establish not even the conditions of a legal discourse of sovereignty. So it's not only a territorial and spatial condition of sovereignty. You have to undo the possibility of a legal condition of sovereignty. And most importantly, you have to undo the possibility of conceiving absolute power within a territory away from its legitimization. So in order to establish that transition from, let's say, intensified communication, which is war, to let's say, less intense communication, which is that moment of peace that we experience today, we have to undo diagrams of power. And in order to do that, we have to outplay power. We have to establish a situation which is at the same time legal and illegal. We have to establish a situation where containment and infrastructural connections are allowed. So Kosovo becomes a mixture, so to say, of the post-national conditions of Cyprus and the division of Cyprus and the exchanges in the passes of Kashmir. That particular condition where enclosure and openness coincide is what Martisari would call the sustained neutrality of Kosovo. That is the third example that I think would be interesting to discuss here. So what is the condition of neutrality is obvious. It's a condition that is liminal. You can never achieve a neutral condition because immediately you will be deluded. Immediately there's a delusion. You actually are taking side. You actually are powerful. So what kind of power is it? If neutrality, if not to take part, becomes a form of power, what kind of power is it? What are the conditions of power? Not just who holds power, but mostly, almost in a Foucauldian condition, what are the hows rather than the who of power? And here is the moment where I would like to introduce a second concept, and that is that neutrality not only shouldn't be conceived as a status but as a practice, but neutrality operates as a practice against a form of power. So it's not just a disengagement, it's not just a withdrawal, it's a practice that actively engages against a specific form of power, which is what Max Weber would call the charismatic. The charismatic in Max Weber is the condition of power that organizes, let's say, the common. It comes from the idea of gift, of the charismata, of faith, that establishes a condition of universal or universality. And for Max Weber, the charismatic power is the condition where the common is formed around the recognition of a gift, as opposed to the bureaucratic power, where the predominant discourse is a legislative discourse. It's a situation of procedures and balances and checks, or against another condition of power, which is the traditional power, or let's say the archaic power, where you conform to a certain relation of power only through inheritance. Let's say the feudal system is a traditional condition of power. Modern states are bureaucratic forms of power. 20th century fascism is operating through charisma, but not through charismatics. And this is the interesting distinction. Weber distinguishes, let's say, from the situation where Mussolini will have charisma and hence will have power, from a situation where he understands and organizes the particular submission and subjectification of power through a process of charismatics. So how can we conceive, let's say, a system of power that is charismatic without having power, without having charisma, without an objectification of that particular thing that we call charisma, that is something that you have or you don't have, that you can give away and take? The particular condition of charisma is interesting in our discussion on perpetual peace and neutrality exactly because it relates to a condition that is situational. It allows us to think, let's say, away from imagination. If imagination refers to images that are not directly present, charisma is the embodiment. It's the possibility of redemption through mere presence. And that's what establishes, let's say, also in Max Weber, the powerful relation of having charisma. Charismatics operates through presence. It's the opposite of, let's say, I would call imagination. It's the situation where you always have an opinion, where you always not only have an opinion, but you show that you have an opinion about everything. And that is, for Weber, the condition that allows the formation of a group. That means a formation of a condition of a public. So what is it not to have an opinion? What is it to disengage from that? What is it just to record, to witness, and to record as an observer, as a third party, that particular condition, if not a system of power that goes and fights against the charisma, that fights against presence, that fights against, let's say, a situational condition in order to establish a practice, in order to establish a flow, a circular relation, let's say, between a number of polities and a number of spaces of operation that are constantly shifted. That is the situation that I wanted to, let's say, share with you about the difficulty of conceiving architecture as a mere presence, as a mere embodiment of things. I think that what we can distinguish through the precise analysis, and today I only managed, unfortunately, because of the time, to show you roughly some hints and just some echoes of those spaces of neutrality, is the condition that architecture is not about presence, it's about transformation. Architecture is the particular agent of a transformation. It's a transformation that links two systems that are constantly changing and drifting away one from the other. A political condition, a polity, a system of more or less organized notions of citizenship, and our spaces of operation. Let's say, what is within our reach. And this is where I think to the particular interest of the Perpetual Peace Project is in this highlighting the difficulty of establishing a public discourse on peace. In order to establish a public discourse of peace, we have to withdraw from it. There's a necessary condition similar to the one that our friend Surgeon was hinting at of Melville. I prefer not to. I decide not. So the decision is a negation and a withdrawal. It's an undoing of an outplay of a relation of power. It's not a dismissal of power. It's a condition that, let's say, changes the rules and establishes a sustained and different space of operation, which hopefully will help and sustain peace. Thank you.